Welcome to New World Next Week. I'm James Corbett of CorbettReport.com.
And I'm James Evan Pilato of MediaMonarchy.com. And we once again, of course, welcome you back to New World Next Week. NewWorldNextWeek.com is where you can go to get large, small file sizes, audio versions, all the things to help spread this information. James, let's get right into it, and we'll take it from a blog post on the Washington Post. Egypt protests told through social media. Days before the demonstrations that rocked Egypt on Tuesday, the 25th, Egyptians used Facebook and Twitter to summon the masses. On Tuesday, dubbed Day of Anger, protesters took to the streets and to social media, updating the world on the protests that raged in Cairo, Alexandria, and other parts of Egypt. Demanding an end to Hosni Mubarak's 30-year reign, Egyptians shouted, "Freedom, oh freedom, Mubarak's regime is standing between us and you." On Wednesday, that would still be today here in the States, the 26th, calm returned to the streets of Cairo for a brief while before protests broke out again. Twitter issued a notice that the service was down in Egypt. The technology blog TechCrunch.com said there were also reports that Facebook is suffering outages as well. Facebook issued a statement saying, "We are aware of reports of disruption to service, but have not seen any major changes in traffic from Egypt." Egypt's government denied any internet services were disrupted, saying the government respected freedom of expression and sought to protect it. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton told MSNBC, quote, "We urge the Egyptian authorities not to prevent peaceful protests or block communications, including on social media sites. We believe strongly that the Egyptian government has an important opportunity at this moment in time to implement political, economic, and social reforms to respond to the legitimate needs and interests of the Egyptian people," end quote. We do have other related links to tell this story, and it, again, is told in social media, and you can look through all the tweets and Facebook posts. We also have a story coming from Threat Level, as well as the most recent I have from about an hour ago from Voice of America, "Protests in Egypt and Tunisia Spark Turmoil." James, you and I have both individually on our shows discussed the situation in turmoil, and now it seems as though in some way it is spreading to Egypt. Are we looking at another Soros or otherwise intelligence-connected color revolution?
Well, I think that has to be a possibility that we have to be at least conscious of and thinking about at this time. I don't want to poo-poo these protests and the significance of them, because I think it is a good thing when a brutal dictatorship gets overthrown. But unfortunately, we have to think about whether this is just serving the interests of the international financial oligarchy, and we have to wonder at that, because one thing that strikes me about the coverage of these protests is that just as in Tunisia, the coverage was often about WikiLeaks, the coverage of this is almost invariably about Twitter. And it's just interesting to me that you cannot find a news story on this that isn't about Twitter or about Facebook, as if somehow these revolutions were only caused and only about the Twitter and Facebook. I mean, it seems to be like it's taking a page from the script of the Open Society Institute, founded and funded by George Soros, where their minions have been writing for years about how Twitter is the revolutionary tool of the masses now. And it just seems to be it's all framed in that context, which is what makes me a little bit wary about this and where it's heading. But again, I think it's good to be fighting against the dictatorial regimes, but it is we have to be wary of what's coming in to take its place.
Absolutely. And again, as we see these things rage kind of worldwide, and we see other situations, whether it's in Ireland or Iceland or in any other nations, the interesting thing for me, I suppose, is now, and as we move to our second story, we come back to the United States, that with all that's going on and with millions of people being foreclosed upon and people running out of their unemployment checks and all of those things, we're still just, you know, watching football games and going about our merry way. So I guess on that note, and keeping with the theme, I guess, of this episode, for our second story from uprisingradio.org, how the Comcast NBC Universal merger affects you and me and all of us. The impending marriage of Comcast and NBC, approved by the FCC last week, is ushering an era of what some call the mega merger. Going into this deal, Comcast is already the nation's largest cable and home broadband provider. NBC Universal, which is owned by General Electric, was formed by a 2004 merger with Vivendi Universal. Now, Comcast takeover of NBC Universal will create an entity controlling 20% of all network and cable TV viewing hours. Of added significance is the fact that this is the first time a cable company will control a major broadcast network. Over the past 2 years, the merger has been under negotiations. Americans' media consumption habits have dramatically shifted toward online video. The FCC admitted that the merged company it approved will pose risks, quote, to the development of innovative online video distribution services, end quote. The Comcast-NBC merger is bringing to fruition the prediction made by legendary journalist Ben Bedikian of an ever-shrinking number of media corporations owning and controlling all media in the U.S., a trend he began documenting way back in 1983 in his seminal book, Media Monopoly. Meanwhile, MSNBC's Countdown host Keith Olbermann announced his departure Friday the 21st, just days after the Comcast-NBC merger was approved, abruptly ending a tenure that had garnered millions of loyal viewers. There's a Freudian slip there. Olbermann's show was the top-rated program at MSNBC and is credited with presenting some progressive balance to the rightward tilt in mainstream media. There is no evidence yet to connect the merger with Olbermann's exit, and Comcast, whose CEO Brian Roberts is openly Republican, has promised not to interfere with the news operations of NBC Universal. Some of the comments at the bottom of this post, I think, are interesting to mention that it gets into you're messing with the powers that be. If you start to speak out against the Obamasiah, as amazingly Olbermann had started to do in the past months, maybe this is what happens to you. So there's the angle of the story that this has to do with the NBC-Comcast merger. An interesting take from Tarpley.net gets into the fact that it just so happens that Obama just appointed the head of GE, a guy named Jeffrey Immelt, to the new White House Council on Jobs and Competitiveness. James, what's your take on this story?
Well, I guess, yeah, at the very top, it just keeps getting to be a smaller and smaller circle of people, and they all seem to be connected, and whether they have a government title or a corporate title really doesn't seem to matter that much in this day and age. So nothing new there, but on the Comcast-NBC merger front, I mean, what can you say about this other than the fact that it's extremely frightening, not only that you have the cable company / internet service provider / media content distributor now merging everything and creating this vertical monopoly over the flow of information, but just the fact that there are so few internet service providers anymore anyway. I was reading on the comments of one of these blogs that in his area there are only two ISPs, and he lives in a major city in the U.S. So, I mean, you choose between Comcast or whatever their rival is, you choose between, you know, blue and red. I mean, it's going to be the same thing in the end. You just there's no choice. So that's it's extremely worrying because I think we all know what this means and where this is heading. And ultimately, if Comcast decides that NBC's content can be streamed a little bit faster than anyone else's, then we start to get into that much dreaded area of pay to play access on the internet and all sorts of very worrying things that can be accomplished through this. So I think it's extremely important that we keep our eye on this. But as for the Olbermann thing, I'm not shedding any tears to see him go. I haven't been a huge fan of him ever since Obama took over. I mean, he has on occasion spoken out against the system, but I think it was quite telling how his incredibly cutting and incisive commentary on the Bush regime seemed to end when Obama came in, and there was occasional glimmers of that, but it was clearly a left-right charade, and I'm just sick of watching and listening to people who are stuck in that paradigm that tells us nothing and that does nothing to change the system.
And I had kind of, I guess, long sort of, I guess, predicted on my own show that once Obama came into power that it wouldn't be long before you would see folks like Olbermann go, oh, okay, well, my job here is done. I can go back to being a sportscaster, which is, I believe, what he was. So, James, let's move to our third and final story. And again, this is kind of a hat trick, I suppose, of media coverage from around the world. This story you sent to me, and it comes from the Daily Mail, and it's written by a former BBC presenter, a guy named Peter Sissons. So it's a massively long article, and this is, of course, coming on the heels of a new book that this ex-BBC presenter has coming out, a guy named Peter Sissons. So let's cut down to, as for what we would actually do in the event of a royal death, the formula was strictly laid down. On the death of what was called a Category A royal, all BBC channels would interrupt their programs, the national anthem would be played over the fluttering royal standard, and the news would be solemnly intoned. A succession of pre-recorded interviews and obituaries would follow, which were stored in a locked cabinet in the newsroom, and there was a list of suitable interviewees who would drop everything and come into the studio to pay tribute. Essentially, the system didn't appear to have changed much since the death of George VI in 1952. Every 6 months or so, we rehearsed all this. A new studio was set aside on a Saturday morning, and we worked through a fictional scenario. Increasingly, and for obvious reasons, the rehearsals focused on the Queen Mother. We usually pretended that she'd expired after choking on a fishbone at her Castle of May. The remoteness of the location posed particular technical challenges, which our rehearsal was expected to help identify. However, on one occasion, we varied the subject. What would we do if the Princess of Wales died? A producer devised a suitable scenario, and with uncanny prescience, the story he came up with for the rehearsal was that she had been killed in a car crash on the M4. It was a good exercise, and most people involved thought nothing more of it. We could forget Diana. But then, on the morning of August 31st, 1997, my bedside telephone rang just after 6 a.m., and a senior BBC producer told me that she had been killed in a car crash in Paris, and he wanted me on the air immediately. And again, this story kind of goes on to talk about what goes on behind the scenes of James, what we've kind of jokingly referred to as the Big Brother Corporation.
Right, yeah, exactly. I mean, I really do encourage people to go and read this article because it provides a lot of those types of details about things that are going on behind the scenes in this media coverage of these things that I don't think there's any great big reveal about some secret control over the media or anything, but it is a fascinating article. On the Princess Diana front, I mean, it's interesting, but until I see anything more about that, I don't know if that is really indicative of anything. I think simultaneous bombs going off on the underground in the exact same locations as they were holding tests or drills of it on that morning. Now, that seems to me something worthy of investigation, that the BBC had a scenario where Princess died in a car crash. I don't know. It may be indicative. It may not be. But the point of this article to me was just the way that the media, all the things that go into these types of things that you don't really think about, the burgundy tie versus the black tie for announcing the death, and all of the newsroom editorial kind of things that go into these decisions, and whether how upset we should be about the Queen Mother's death, or whether we should downplay it, and things like that. Just a lot of very interesting little insights, and I know as sort of a media guy, I'm sure you have some comments on what you thought about the article.
I mean, very early on, and I have a media studies degree, you know, communications 101, you essentially learn that nothing is accidental. It is all planned and scripted to the T. The interesting thing that Peter Sissons gets into is that, and if we could kind of extrapolate this out to all of our war of terror, homeland security drills and all of those kind of things, that you can practice and drill and do all those things as much as you want, but a lot of times when it actually goes down, that training goes out the window, just as Peter Sissons discusses and why he ends up getting in trouble because he was kind of on his own and asked his own questions, and the heads didn't like that. James, we're just about out of time here.
Okay, all right. Well, another great episode, and I think that's it for this week. So tune into MediaMonarchy.com, tune into CorbettReport.com. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Take care.